and conducting.
I'm your host, Gia Scott. I'm very glad that you joined me today. The official marker of the end of summer is just around the corner with Labor Day here in the United States. And schools have been open for fall classes for the last few weeks, and the remainder will surely be open by this time next week. Now, if you're a parent, that means your schedule has once again become regimented, and your days put into an order determined by your children's schools. Some of you may like that regimentation and sense of order. Others may resent it, especially when it conflicts with your own work schedule. Same is true of your children. Some love school, some hate it. Some learn well there, and some learn better in alternative environments. Over the summer, we've had some very interesting guests and covered a wide variety of topics, and I've had more fun than I would have ever dreamed possible as I've brought these guests to you to hear. I've also learned lots of stuff. Sometimes a show that I really sort of dreaded doing because of the topic would actually turn out to be intensely interesting, as well as much more positive and upbeat than I could have ever imagined. I've often been told that live radio is always a surprise, but I don't think the ones doing the warning necessarily meant it the way that it's been a surprise for me. Now myself, I'm an empty nester now. There are no small pitter-pattering feet, unless you're going to call my two dogs and demonic alien cat pitter-pattering feet. Now, I do come from a family that is very child-oriented, and one of the best experiences of my life was that of being a parent. Many people would assume that a parent teaches a child, but in fact, I would say that I learned more from my children than I could have possibly ever taught them. Some of the most wondrous moments of my life occurred when I showed something to a child, saw their face light up with sheer wonder, and got to experience seeing it through their own eyes. A whole different perspective than I'd ever seen before. Sometimes, I think as adults, we clutter up our lives, our spirituality, and our perceptions way too much with knickknacks that really don't mean anything. And having it stripped back down to youthful wonder is a very good thing. Next month, the theme of the month will be spirituality, and don't groan and expect religious dogma. Some of the ideas that we'll discuss will be pure speculation, wild ideas grabbed from the ether. I have three of the four shows planned out, and something tells me that fourth show is just going to plan itself, and the guest will suddenly seem to appear from nowhere for the show. After all, my third guest did exactly that, so, hey, we'll see what happens with that fourth one. Also, tune into the show during September, and we're going to have a surprise giveaway, too. You don't want to miss that part. Spirituality is something that does make many people uncomfortable. It doesn't come from a book of memorized prayers and songs. It doesn't arrive with the observance of ritual. You won't find it in any building waiting at an altar. It doesn't even arrive on beams of light filtered through a stained glass window. For some people, it arrives at their physically weakest moment, as the body nearly completely shuts down, and in some cases is actually pronounced dead. Many of us know or have met someone who has had a near-death experience of some kind, and many of you may have had the experience yourself. One sector of those experiences that is rarely talked about is the child experiencer. Childhood is supposed to be fun and games, not death and dying. Last month, PMH Atwater was on and we discussed adult experiences, barely touching on the child experiences despite their profound nature. These experiences are often life-changing. And to have your life change so young, sometimes even before you drew your first breath, is mind-boggling. So, with no more babbling on my part, I now introduce PMH Atwater. PMH, could you give the audience a brief synopsis of who you are, as well as don't forget to mention your website and your book?
Well, hey, I'm just a person. I just blew the whole thing. I have this wonderful intro, and I just blew it. Well, anyway, I'm a researcher of near-death states, have been since 1978. I'm one of the original in the field. I have to date what we think is the largest research base, nearly 4,000 adults and children. I've written a lot of books about adult experiencers and the after effects of near-death states. I've only written a couple, though, about the kids, and those books really focused on the near-death experience as seen from the child's eyes, not from the eyes of the adult researcher or the adult person who might be interested in, you know, taking another look. If we want to take a brief little interlude here, I can introduce everybody to two of my newest. One came out 2 weeks ago. That's Runes of the Goddess.
Uh-huh.
That's out in book, as a single book. It's also out in kit form, complete with the runes and the pouch and the casting cloth and so forth.
Uh-huh.
It's also out in a CD, and deepening of our understanding of what these particular runic glyphs mean. And then there's a guided shamanic meditation on the CD as well. So on my website, as of this week, Monday, I now have an online shop where you can buy stuff from me. I've never had that before. Ever. And so just before the lunar eclipse, which was early this morning, we launched my online bookstore. And it's off my website, which is myname.com. So it's www.pmhatwater.com. And just get on there, and either on the left or the right, there's mention of the online, I think it's called a bookstore or shop. And you get on there, and you can get the kit directly from me if you want. You can also get the CD directly from me. I do not carry just the book alone. You'd have to get that from the publisher, or you can get it from Amazon.com. But I do have the kit, and I do have the CD. And then in October, the big book is coming.
The big book.
Yeah, it's called The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, The Ultimate Guide to What Happens When We Die. It's 496 pages. So when I say it's a big book, I'm not kidding.
Nope, you're not kidding.
It has everything, absolutely everything you've ever wanted to know about the near-death experience, its after effects and implications, as seen from 360 degrees, positive, negative. Everything is there, including an update on all the material, all the research, as of spring of 2007. So when I say it's fresh, it's new, it's big, I mean just that. And I think we're going to do a show on that big book, aren't we, in October?
Yes, we are. I think it's about the 16th when you come on.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, so we'll discuss that book on that show.
That is really... well, you know, it was a surprise to me, Gia, that Newsweek magazine picked up on this book in their online version of their magazine story called Back from the Dead. I don't know if your listeners remember that particular issue of Newsweek magazine. It was only a couple of weeks ago. There was on the cover was this guy in a swimming pool, and it said, "This man was letters." And it was one of their most popular articles that had appeared in their magazine. Well, if you got on the online version of that magazine, every screen that you went through, and there was like, I don't know, four, five, six of them, were pictures from my book, The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences. And then at the end of it, they said, "Buy it now." So I pressed on that button because I didn't know what would happen. And I wound up in Amazon.com, and they're already running a pre-publication sale on the book, and I did not know that. Nor did I know that Newsweek was going to pick up my book. So it was all a complete surprise to me. I mean a complete surprise.
Uh-huh.
Just had no idea. So there it is.
Well, it's nice when surprises are good ones.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is. So here I am, hot to trot, with more material more books, more adventures, more ideas, more research, and more joy.
Well, a lot of people assume when they hear the name near-death experiences, and they're like, you know, rolling their eyes, it's like, oh yeah, whatever, you know, you see angels or you see the devil and you're judged and they kick you back because you haven't done anything right. It's not like that at all, at least from what I've read.
Well, it's far more complicated than that. Much more complicated than that. What we know about the near-deathians, I should say the near-death phenomenon, because it is a phenomenon that includes the experience and the after effects. It includes both. So you can't talk about one without the other.
Right.
You can't just talk about the otherworldly experiences people have without also talking about afterward, the consequences of. And yes, there is a spread of after effects, both physiological and psychological. So when you're talking about near-death experiences, you're not just talking about people who die and come back. You're talking about a whole broad range of material and how that impacts the human family. And we're finding out that it impacts us far more than we thought it did. And certainly it shows a lot more about consciousness, about what we as human beings are capable of doing and what we're capable of being. And that's the real surprising thing. You know, most people think, well, you know, it's going to follow this pattern of an out-of-body experience and going through a tunnel and then winding up in
the bright light.
You know,
by
loved ones, and then you come back.
And it's all caused by oxygen deprivation.
Right, right. Well, guess what? It's not that simple.
Well, I was talking about your book and your research with someone earlier today, and I said, you know what? It's not like we can send a probe to the afterlife and bring it back with data. This is Mars we're talking about. Near-death experiences are as close as we can come.
Right. In fact,
oh, yeah, I'm glad we have the people who channel some, you know, messages from the dead and whatnot, and they talk about it. But, you know, as far as without using channeling or any psychic means, this is as close as we can come to finding out what happened.
The near-death experience and deathbed visions. And of those two, the most verified and definable is the near-death experience. So, yes, it's as close as we can get. And, you know, when you consider experiences occur for an adult or a child or a baby, babies can have them.
Oh, I was surprised. In your book, you talked about prenatal experiences.
Sure, we have pre-birth experiences. Yes, anyone at any age. So that's before birth as well as after birth can have a near-death experience, remember it, and then talk about it once they're verbal or, you know, are capable in language. A lot of the kids, when they start to talk about their near-death experiences, are put down by their parents. They are yelled at or shouted out, that's just your imagination, or shut up, I don't want to hear this stuff. And, you know, put down.
Or even, you know, even if you're just mildly poo-pooed, it would be a deterrent to talking about something that even a small child might feel very strong about.
Over 60% of the children in my research base repress their experience because of things like that. Yep. They swallowed it or tucked it away.
You know, initially you're reading this and you're kind of going, how can someone something before they're born? But my mother talks about she was hanging wallpaper, you know, in the last few weeks before I was born. And every time they would crack, I guess at that time, a roll of wallpaper had an end on it of some kind that they could crack off by whacking it against the stairs.
Uh-huh.
And it would make this loud crack, you know, she said, almost as loud as a rifle. And every time they would crack off the end of one of these, while I was still prenatal, I would jump. you know, so you know, I was reacting to sound.
Sure.
Now, of course, the old wives' tale was, and her relatives were having a cow because she was hanging clothes and hanging wallpaper. The cord's going to be around the baby's neck, and guess what? They were right.
Very often they are.
You know,
very often.
I don't know if it really has anything to do with the superstition, the old wives' tale, whatever, was that you don't hang things because you'll hang the baby.
Well, you know, we can talk about all old wives' tales all we want, but the interesting thing is many of them turn out to be true.
Yeah, you know.
And they're really, a lot of them are just based on common sense. So if a person would just use their noggin and figure this out, they would realize that that really wouldn't be very wise, doing a lot of reaching when you're carrying a child, especially when that child is larger and about to be born. Doing a lot of reaching would not be a wise thing to do. That doesn't mean the child is going to have the cord wrapped around their neck, but, you know, it does indicate that that might be a problem.
Yeah, you know, and you know, it was interesting to read stories about that. And at first I was kind of going, I don't know. And then I got to thinking, you know, my first memories, I couldn't speak yet. I was having a very hard time communicating to, in that particular memory, it's my grandfather, what I wanted, because I didn't have words yet. You know, all I could do was point and babble, you know?
You knew what you wanted, but you didn't have the words yet, right?
Yeah. You know, and I got to thinking, I was probably 7, 8 months old. You know, going by the time of year and the time of year I was born, you know, 7, 8 months old, I really didn't probably have many words yet.
Well, what we're finding with child experiencers of near-death states is that they can recall things, incredible details that occurred while they were very, very young or even before they were born, that later on are verified in third-party fications. So that's when you have to just sort of stop for a minute. Let me give an example from my research. My research with children, I'm claiming 277 child experiences or near-death states. Of those, about half of them could remember their birth, and when I was able to talk with the parents and check this out, every one of them that told me details, they did indeed check out. About one third of them had pre-birth memory. So, and that pre-birth memory began around the age of about 7 months in utero. Right around 7 months in utero was when we could trace the memories back that they would speak of, or the things that they saw or heard or were aware of. Now, in medical science, we know that what they call the fetus is responding to pain at about 6 months in utero, between 6 to 7 months in utero. So about that same time that the fetus is responding to pain as if they were a birthed baby seems to be about the same time that the brain is kicking in and the faculties are kicking in a very powerful and lively way. And what we're finding with these children with pre-birth memory is it's as if they can see outside the womb and hear what their parents say and remember that, especially if there's a lot of emotion involved with it, you know, whether it's traumatic or joyful, happy, sad,
that goes hand in hand with wives' tales, because, you know, you weren't supposed to get upset, you weren't supposed
right.
to have any sort of conflict around you, because it would mock the baby.
Well, the babies, these babies, pre-birth babies, babies that aren't born yet, do indeed seem to remember those things that are the most emotional. And again, positive or negative, doesn't matter which end of the swing. That, you know, does seem to mark them in the sense that they hear it, they respond to it, they see it, and they remember. See, again, I want to say that it's as if they can see outside of the womb. It's as if, well, you know, if you want to be kind of funny, if you want to be kind of joke around a little bit, it's as if the womb has a view, you know, a womb with a view kind of thing.
Yeah.
it's like they can see outside the womb.
And, you know, in my own case, okay, my daughter is now 25 years old. The last trimester, I played a lot, almost continuously, of Renaissance music. And I crocheted incessantly. And I read. She loves books. She has a fascination with strings. And she absolutely adores Renaissance music, which I have never listened to since she was born. I chose it because of that calming thing, you know? It wasn't something that I even cared for. I haven't crocheted anything since she was very, very small. And, you know, not that she did crochets, but, you know, I didn't have a string thing, you know? it was something I was doing because of her.
I'd like to give an example here that I think the listenership might relate a little bit more to, and that is the number of cases I came across of children, male and female, who are now born. They get a little bit older. Maybe they're 2 years old, 3 years old. Usually it's around two, about two and a half, sometimes a little bit older. If there was an attempt to add an abortion of them, or if the mother thought about having an abortion, they seem to be born fearful of the mother. And in this one particular case, it was a girl. Once she was verbal, she went up to her mother and kind of tugged at the mother's skirt. It wasn't that long ago when women actually wore dresses. And this little girl was going up to the mother and tugging at her mother's dress and said, "Mommy, Mommy, why did you try to kill me when I was in your tummy?" And I talked to the mother. And she was just, she was white-faced, she was horrified, and she said, in defense of her actions, she said, "I never really did it. I just thought about doing it. I thought about it in my head. I never said anything to anyone. I had older children. We didn't have very much money. I felt that if I had another child, it would be cheating the children I already had. I really didn't want to have another child, and in my mind, I really seriously considered having an abortion, but she said I just couldn't go through with it." Well, this daughter was born with all of those thoughts, her mother's thoughts, in her head. And she,
I have heard of that before.
And she had a very clear concept, a very clear understanding of what her mother was considering doing. And you know, she and her mother, she could never bond with her mother, and they always had a very strained relationship. And it's one of those sad kind of after effects or consequences of that kind of thing. But it amazed me how many of the children would come back and start talking about this kind of thing.
Well, hold that thought, because now it is time for that first break.
Oh, okay.
So, everyone in the audience, take a deep breath, get your drink of water, and the Donna Shades will be right back with her guest, PMH Atwater.
Mm-hmm. Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is James Arthur Manchick with the Black Knight Talk Radio. I invite you to join me on a road to choice in the path to non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goal of examining a subject matter in its own merits and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality. All to pre-drawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings there. Pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or highway attitudes. But there are no free passes here either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. Like a contradiction.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight's guest is PMH Atwater, and our topic is the new children and near-death experiences. PMH, before we get started again, I would like you to give us your website and book information and the book that we're talking about right now.
Well, my website is www.pmhatwater.com, pmhatwater.com. In other words, myname.com.
Uh-huh.
We're talking tonight about material that's in the book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. I'm one of the original researchers in the field of near-death studies. Began my work in 1978. I've written 9 books about my findings. Some of my findings are now being verified in clinical prospective studies. I'm in the Lancet Medical Journal because one of my findings was verified in that very, very large near-death study conducted in Holland a few years ago. So I wound up in Lancet, let's see, it was December 15, 2001, I believe. I told everybody I got an Oscar for Christmas because that's what it felt like, you know. In my field, for me to wind up in Lancet Medical Journal is a really big deal.
Yeah.
And I'd like all your listeners to know that as of this week, Monday, I now have an online shop on my website. So if you want to buy any of my stuff any time of the day, you certainly can do that. And
I had a little bird tell me if they buy it off of your site, they also get it autographed.
They certainly do. They certainly do. I would be very happy to do that. So, yes, indeedy. So jump right in. And I think that's the main things that we can say. Runes of the Goddess is just out in kit, in book, and in CD. And the big book of near-death experiences is coming out in October. So those are the main things I'm currently braving or starting on or getting up enough courage to delve into finishing up my theoretical model, and that's going to take a lot of organization just to get started. So that's my next project, and you know, I'm kind of sort of starting it, but not with the enthusiasm I really need to do yet. And I think it's because of all of the organization that's necessary. I look at that big pile of research on my floor and my desk, say to myself, oh, groan. You know, I really don't want to get into that, but yet I know I must, I need to, and I will. So eventually I'll have the courage and the energy to do that.
Speaking of research,
Yes.
In your book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences, how did you do the research for that book?
I focused on the children themselves and seeing it through their eyes. Their eyes, their way. And I'm the only person so far in the field of near-death studies to do that. All of the other information that we have on children's experiences, and we don't have a lot, was all done by adults, seeing it through the eyes of adults and comparing their cases to adult models.
Uh-huh.
Certainly I'm an adult, but I went into this with children with the idea of seeing it through their eyes, their way, and only comparing it with other children to see if I could get a better sense of what a child goes through, but especially what a child thinks and how they feel about what happens to them. That was very, very important to me. I'd already done thousands of adults. I wanted to get a better, clearer idea of the child. And when I did that, it really changed a lot of things and turned a lot of things upside down. Not because a child has a different kind of experience. They can have the same experiences an adult has, although usually their experiences tend to be a little bit more simple and don't have as many components in them. Where they differ is the integration of the after effects or the after effects. And many times with a child, it can be just exactly the opposite as to what an adult would do. Let me give you just a quick example before we get further into children. Afterward, the average adult wants to get rid of house mortgages. They want to get rid of their bills or get rid of their mortgages and start life over or do things differently, or they're now dedicated to other ways of living, other ways of doing things, and one of the first things they want to do is toss their mortgage.
Uh-huh.
Not all of them are like that, but most of them are like that. Children are exactly the opposite. One of the first things they want to do is to get a mortgage, and they will do everything they can to make those mortgage payments, even if that means they don't have enough money for furniture. Even if that means they have to scrimp and save in every other way. And so I did a lot of probing. You know, why? Why do they want a mortgage on a home? And I came to realize after, you know, hundreds of these cases with kids that their experience in the bright worlds on the other side of death,
uh-huh,
they considered to be like their homey home. That was their home place. And when their experience ended, the average child will blame themselves for the fact that the bright worlds go away. They'll blame themselves in the sense that they will think, what did I do wrong? Did I do something wrong? Did I drive the angels or the bright ones away? Where did the people go? Oh, I must have done something wrong. A child tends to internalize or blame themselves if there's any change in their environment or anything happens that seems somehow against what they think ought to happen. So children very often, and I found this over and over and over again, and it's like this one little girl, after her near-death experience, she was one of these who blamed herself, you know, what did I do wrong that the bright people went away? And afterward, for years afterward, this little kid would go around in the closet, she'd look under the bed, she'd look in the attic, no matter where she was, didn't matter where she was. She would go looking and looking and looking, knocking on doors and looking, trying to find the bright ones who went away to invite them back. You know,
wow.
Kids don't understand why this is happening. So we've got a lot of this sense of you know, where did they go? Why did they go away? Kind of thing. So,
do they often think of, you know, they're bad and that's why they went away?
Some of them do. Some of them do. This one little girl did. She thought she had done something wrong. Not all of them think that way. They just wonder, you know, where did they go? And why did they go away? And so that very often is a major thing for children. So very often it's really kind of tough for them to deal with the idea of losing their home. And I was able to make this link, Gia. I was able to make this link between loss of their home and the fact that as soon as they can get a home, even if it's a physical one in the earth plane, as soon as they can get a home, they don't want to let go of it. You know, they're going to make their payments no matter what. Now, not all kids are like that, but the majority of child experiencers are like that. And it just amazed me. And a lot of it can, you know, it has certainly with the difference in the learning curve. Adults are older. They've lived most of their life or a lot of their life. And their interest turns in different ways. But still, there was this direct link that I found, and it is a direct link, between loss of home and I want to get a home, and I don't want to ever let it go away. So that's one of those total opposites. Another total opposite is this idea about religion or church. And with adult experiencers, clearly two-thirds of them leave church afterwards. Clearly right. Two-thirds leave. About a third stay and do everything they can to help the church they're in or help the church change or grow or become more dynamic or become more powerful in their lives and in the lives of others. But two-thirds of them leave. And they're leaving the Orthodox Church and taking on a more spiritual relationship with God. So for them, God becomes more personal afterward, or that idea of oneness or deity or the source. Not all of them continue to title G-O-D, God, but they do keep this idea of deity. So, you know, I still use the term, but some people call it the force or the one or the mind or source or...
It really doesn't matter.
No, it really doesn't matter.
It's a label designating a concept, you know.
But you know, the average adult will tend to leave. And one of the interesting things I found is about 10 years later, the average adult will come back to some form of church or some form of church fellowship. And very often that's a different kind of church than what they had before. Like, for instance, a Unity Church or Science of Mind kind of church or Unitarian Church or a church that's more open. But with kids, again, just the opposite occurs, where adults tend to walk out the door of a church, kids run to the doors of churches and want to get in. And what interests me is it doesn't seem to matter to the child what kind of church. It to them, it's God's house. And they want to be where God is. And I've noticed with so many of these child experiencers, they'll set up an altar in their bedroom. How old they are, they'll set up an altar in their bedroom, and they just automatically know that anything on that altar is sacred and special, and they treat it in that manner. Now, again, they're not all like that, but the majority are. And this fascinates me. So this idea of integrating the after effects, the average child does not integrate their after effects. They don't. Adults integrate. Children compromise. Or negotiate, or adjust.
Uh-huh.
They don't integrate. they don't integrate, they don't begin to integrate their experiences usually until about 20 years afterward, where it takes the average adult maybe 7 years to, certainly 7 years, that's now been established in medical research, and that's one of my findings that wound up in Lancet Medical Journal. It takes the average adult 7 years to begin to integrate their experience. But that's adult experiencers, child experiencers. It takes, you know, from 20 to 30 years. And that's because they repress their experience. They repress it. And they don't connect the dots. They don't connect the dots between how different they are, how different they feel, with what happened to them.
So, you know, they repress these memories. And, you know, how do they come out again?
Well, with a lot of the child experiencers, once they get a little older, they'll hear about this from other people, or they'll read about it, or they'll be on the Internet, and they'll wind up reading about these cases. And especially if they read about something that's very similar to what they went through, it's like bingo, you know, right away. There's this revelation, oh, that happened to me. And then they go back, you know, and begin to compare, and they begin to connect the dots.
Uh-huh.
One of the really kind of pulls on your heart kind of thing, it's the average adult can pound on doors, ask questions, get some kind of help or assistance, to aid them in understanding what happened to them and how to deal with it. The average child cannot do that.
Well, you know, in some of them you're dealing with infants who can't even verbalize yet.
Right. So even when they're older, if they go to a counselor or a therapist for assistance in talking out or going over what might have happened to them, the average psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, therapists are not prepared at all for dealing with these people. And it's a very different kind of session that you need to have with them. It's a very different kind of need that they have from the average person. And in my book, on my website, I give suggestions of the kind of counseling that is helpful. And I give name, address, phone numbers.
Uh-huh.
So that people will have recourse, they'll have a door to pound on, which they don't have now. And I'm hopeful that more and more counselors and therapists and our medical people will catch on and realize that, you know, this is kind of different. And let's study about how to handle it, because now there's a lot of information out. There didn't used to be. Even 5 years ago, Gia, there wasn't. You know, there wasn't much out there.
No, and I can, you know, and as someone who's dealt with, you know, people with other repressed memories, you know, granted, the new children can be a trigger and activate those memories, but do you find that sometimes it's a trigger to activating false memories that perhaps they use it to blame other things on?
I haven't found that with children.
Well, I was talking about adults who remember repressed memories.
Adults.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me.
I was wondering whether, you know, people who suddenly decide, oh, I have a repressed memory of a near-death experience as a child, you know, they're adults now.
No, I haven't run across that. Now, maybe some other people have, but I haven't.
Okay.
What I have run across are adults as adult experiencers who either phony their case, who exaggerate their case, or who make it up. And I have run across a number of those. One of them became rather famous in the sense that it was picked up by an online researcher.
Uh-huh.
He told Kenneth Ring, a very well-known near-death researcher,
uh-huh,
about it, sort of a compadre or of mine. And
uh-huh,
then Ken wrote it up in his book, and come to find out, the whole story was made up because the woman got the case from my book, which was written many years previously, and almost word for word from my book.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, the,
you know, I don't know why people do that.
To have done it. She wanted to have had this kind of experience. She didn't have it, so she pulled it out of my book.
Okay, yeah.
And got everybody else all excited, you know.
Those people must exist in just about every field that, you know,
well,
you deal with.
Yeah, you know, it seems like they are there. But you can usually recognize a true, real near-death experiencer when you're around them. There are certain signs you look for, and, you know, they're there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, and I'm sure, too, you know, it's like anything else, you know, any type of an interview you do or with someone with information, whether it's police work, skill, you know, interviewing them about their skills, or whether it's near-death experiences, you interview them repeatedly, they're going to essentially snitch on themselves, whether or not they know what they're talking about.
Well, this woman did get caught, so that's the way it works. What I've run across the most often are people who are true near-death experiencers, who did not experience the tunnel, and who made up that portion to their experience because they wanted to feel like they were a typical near-death experiencer. They did not want to feel different, and they felt that they had to have experienced the tunnel in order to be a real near-death experiencer. And that is so sad, because what a lot of people fail to realize is that the tunnel component to the near-death experience is not a signature feature of the experience at all. There are not that many people who experience the tunnel. And and because of our media, because of movies, because of a lot of books out there, mm-hmm. there is this mistaken conception that in order for it to be a near-death experience, you have had to have gone through a tunnel. And that's just simply not true. It's not true of the adults. It's not true of the kids. In my research base, about a third of the people experienced a tunnel, not quite a third. So that's not even the majority. You know, that's a ways away. It's a good amount, but it's not that many. And yet we seem to think that people have to experience the tunnel. You know, the most common components to the near-death experience is the light and the out-of-body experience. And that light is not just a light, but there's something very intelligent and interactive and warm and loving and incredible about this light. It's not like a light bulb. It's not like the light you see if you've been knocked out. It's not like the light that you see if you press a certain in the top of the eye sockets and, you know, press upward, there's a certain light you can see. It's not like that kind of light at all. It's a very
specific and unique experience.
Yeah, right. And then the out-of-body experience. Some people have a quickie, and even the quickies can include a lot of detail. And
well,
that's
just out of curiosity, and you know, I've read a number of cases of yours where the person was in a coma or was, you know, clinically dead for several minutes. In children, you know, do some of these experiences, are they very, very brief where, you know, to the parents maybe they didn't seem to lose consciousness for more than a few seconds?
Well, that's true. Although in the average near-death experience, the person is dead from 5 to 20 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Now that's average, and I hope your listeners are not panicking here, because we know that between 3 to 4 minutes, if the brain is not getting oxygen, you can have brain damage.
Uh-huh.
This is one of the signature features of the near-death experience. This is how you tell, or this is one of the ways that you can tell if it is a near-death experience, is that no matter how long the person is dead, i.e. no vital signs, no brain wave registering on machines, no breath, nothing like that happening, just no vital signs whatsoever, including brain markers, nothing happening, the person is dead.
Well, hang on. We're going to have to go to dead airspace for a second here.
Oh,
folks,
sorry.
Yeah, I know. It's bad time.
This is why we call
it Folks, it's the top of the hour and time for a break. Grab your glass of water and some popcorn and hang on to your seat. The Dawn of Shades will be right back with our guest, PMA Chatwater.
You are listening to the Paranormal Radio Network.
you do it, babe. You know all the things we know. Won't you stand back for truth? Won't you turn away to?
Get your dose of truth with the Truth Hurts Radio Show with your host, Charles Giuliani, Monday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. The Truth Hurts. Ignorance counts.
Angels and teens and light beings walk beside you.
Oh, I wanted to know.
That not only are you their creation, you may be them as well.
Oh, I wanted
to know that you have been trapped in your own beliefs, in your own mind, and never knowing who and what you truly are.
Let's explore this concept some things. You don't know what they have to say. Join us Sunday nights, 8 Pacific, 11 Eastern. I'm Joshua James, your host of Sunday nights on the Urban Radio Network. See you soon.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Do you like to ask questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Perspective. We all have one. Our entire view of the world is based on it. Welcome to the Unabridged Universe. We invite you to set your perspective aside for a moment and join us on a refreshing journey into aspects of your universe that you may not have noticed from your particular point of view. Let host Jason Wilson be your guide into the corners of the universe you've never peeked into before. Who knows? You may just enjoy it and end up coming back for more. Take a stroll into the Unabridged Universe, live Saturdays from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time, only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is Jim Mazatha, Munchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to trust in the path to non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter in its own merits, and test how it stands up to the big possibilities found in reality. All the predrawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings there. Pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or highway attitudes. But there are no free passes going either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. To make a contradiction to the final question. Feed to the fire. Sunday evenings. I listen. Let me introduce you to the
Okay, welcome back to the Dar Shades. I am your host, Tia Scott, and we are talking tonight with PMH Atwater about the new children and near-death experiences. If you would like to call in with a question or comment, you may do so at 1-877-786-0562, which is toll-free in the United States, or by joining our virtual audience at www.paltalk.com in the Paranormal Radio Network room in Social Issues. And PMH, we sort of left everybody on a cliffhanger.
Yes, we did.
You want to finish that thought?
I'm sorry about that. The average person, no matter the average near-death experiencer, no matter how long they are dead, come back with little or no brain damage. Some come back brain damage, but most do not. Even if they were an hour or more, most do not come back brain damaged. In fact, they come back brain enhanced. They wind up smarter than they were before. And that's a signature feature. That is to say, the majority are like that, especially children. Now, in my research base, most of the children died from drowning, a lot of them from suffocation, child abuse, sibling abuse, tonsillectomies, believe it or not, major surgery, high fever, and lightning, but most of them died from drowning. And what I found is that the younger the child that has... The younger the individual is, the child is, that has a near-death experience, the more impacted they are physically, especially the brain. And it seems as if once a child has a near-death experience, it's like the experience itself is intense. It's like it's a power punch. No matter what kind of experience it is, it seems somehow to rewire them. And they come back smarter than they were before. And I give a lot of percentages in the book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences, and it's really quite amazing. In my research base of 277 child experiencers, 48% came back when they were old enough to take, you know, your standard IQ test. They came back with scores of between 150 to 160 with no genetic markers to account for it. None. And, you know, the average teacher, if you talk to them, they'll say, well, for genius, it's between 134 to 136. And another teacher will say, no, the score for genius begins at 140. This is 48% of these kids are coming back scoring between 150 to 160. And in my research of children, my range was birth to the age of 15 years. So I considered those, you know, that was the range of my research, their ages. But most of the cases I found were not quite 6 years old. So from birth until not quite 6 years of age.
Okay.
So if I just look at the little ones, those that were not quite 6 years old,
right,
and had a near-death experience, the range of children scoring those kind of figures in standard IQ tests were 81%.
Whoa.
The younger the child, the bigger the jump. Now, hold on, Gia. If the child had the near-death experience between birth and the age of 15 months, especially if they had a dark light experience instead of bright light experience, almost every one of them came back with genius, and their scores began 180 and went up into the 200s.
Wow.
The younger the child, the bigger the jump. What I found with these, and of course not all of them are like that, but many of them are. They come back very intuitive, very inventive, very psychic, very creative, just incredible jumps. And, of course, not all of them are able to do anything with this because of their family and their environment. But what I noticed is, and I noticed this with adults too, that after a near-death experience, they come back with the ability to abstract. And they're really good at it. Most of them at spatial reasoning, but especially the ability to abstract. Let me give you an example of abstractions.
Okay.
Now, this is not a near-death experiencer. This is an average little kid.
Okay.
Her she's 2 years old. Her name is Michaela, and she's having a discussion with her mother at the age of two. And she gets very frustrated, puts her hands on her hips, walks up to her mother, and then takes one finger and points it in her mother's face and wiggles it and says, "I don't know the word for that yet." Now, how does a two-year-old know that they don't know for something yet? That's abstraction.
Yes.
With abstraction, not only do the kids, do people think outside the box, but there's no box there to begin with. So these are people who are able to conceptualize and abstract at very high levels, very broad levels. It's just, you know, 360 degree abstractions.
Uh-huh.
And you've got little kids like, let me give you an example from my research base. This little boy, first grade, had a near-death experience during the Christmas break, a drowning.
Okay.
Once he was well enough to get back in school. Now this is first grade, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're with me on this. Most of the kids in the first grade are studying or reading Sea Spot Run. You know, Dick and Jane.
Yeah, nothing's real exciting yet.
Yeah, okay. This little boy comes back and he's reading Greek mythology. And he goes up to his teacher and he says, "Why was the book Robinson Crusoe ever written?" That's abstraction. That's
okay.
Advanced abstraction. This is a first grader. And it was literally overnight.
Uh-huh.
And we're finding these kind of jumps and these kind of abstractions, these kinds of novelties and anomalies that are happening over and over and over again with child experiencers.
Now, has this been a phenomenon that has occurred through the ages?
Yes.
Near-death experience in children?
Yes.
Because a lot of people talk about the indigo children, the children that are being born in the last 20, 30 years that are different than children were before. So I want to make sure that, you know, we're not dealing with a similar phenomena.
In a way, it is similar.
Okay.
I noticed this, the new children being born now are matches for child experiencers, for children who have near-death states. So these children who come back from near-death states,
uh-huh,
are almost perfect matches for the new kids. And I would invite you to take the term indigo and crystal and starseed and transition and on and on and on. Take all of these labels and toss them.
Well, I use the term indigo because people are familiar with it. You know, earlier I said, I really don't like that term, but we don't have a better one.
Yes, we do. It's called The New Children, and wrote a book about it called Beyond the Indigo Children, The New Children, and the Coming of the Fifth World.
Ah.
And let's just call them The New Children because that's a neutral term. If you take all of these characteristics for all these labels...
The labels
and
make me crazy,
you know,
in those little pigeonholes, you know?
Yeah. If you just take all the characteristics, put them all together... Bunch them all together. Toss the labels, bunch the characteristics together. Then you have the profile of the new children, which are new kids, do not match any other generation of record. So yes, I cover this very thoroughly in my book, Beyond the Indigo Children. I really challenge how we're now addressing these kids, how we're boxing them in and pigeonholing them into exclusive arrangements of characteristics when it's much broader than that, it's much bigger than that. You can't pigeonhole the kids anyway because they're all evolving. And then in my on my website, you can get the addendum to the book where I update the book and keep it updated. It's called Beyond the Indigo Children Extras. And it's well over 30 pages of name, address, phone number, all kinds of facts and figures, anything that you might want to know about the new kids. But yes, they're similar in the sense of characteristics. Because the new kids being born now are really, really smart. I don't care if they're flunking in school and can't spell. They're really, they're smart kids.
Like I told my daughter, I said, spelling really isn't as important as it used to be. We have spell check now. When I was a kid, there was no such thing.
Yeah, forget that kind of stuff. I mean, the new kids are natural-born entrepreneurs, healers, psychics, creative geniuses. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Well, child experiencers of near-death states are very, very similar. In fact, in many cases, it's a perfect match. So what's happening to our children today? Well, obviously, they're being changed. Obviously, they're being rewired. Obviously, they're coming back with new and different brains. Yeah. Why? Well, maybe it's because our world is changing.
Yeah, I do have a question from the virtual auditorium, though.
Sure.
And the question is, she's wondering if the older kids with near death also have experienced different taste buds, different, like, personalities.
I don't know what she means by different personalities, but they come very different, whether it's an adult or a child. They come back very different, and they can seem as if they have a different personality. Yes, indeed, that is true. Because they will tend to have different characteristics, different traits, or expansions of traits they already have. What I have noted in my research, adult or child, is that they don't really come back different people. What they do is they come back expanded versions of who and what they already were. So it takes talents that were repressed or not expressed, and it surfaces those.
Uh-huh.
They come to the surface, and they're very usable, and they're right there from now on. The children will tend to respond in different ways. They will act differently. They certainly have different interests. So in that sense, what she's talking about is very true. Can they have different taste buds or taste things differently.
You were talking about in your book that I forget the term right now. It escaped me. I thought of it a few minutes ago.
Oh, sorry about that.
Where you when you see something, you say you see colors and taste the colors.
Oh, synesthesia.
Yeah.
Synesthesia. That is a typical after effect of near-death states, be it an adult or a child.
Okay.
And we know that to be an elaboration of the limbic system in the brain, that somehow it is expanded or altered in some manner. And so the individual now gets multiple sensations or sensory reports from a given object instead of just a single one. Let me give you an example. It would be very typical for a near-death experiencer, adult or child, let's say in this case it's an adult, and they're going to go buy a picture for a decoration in their home, maybe their bedroom, and they'll buy it not only according to what it looks like and the colors, but they'll also buy it according to how it sounds. You see, they're getting the visual, but they're also getting the audio at the same time.
Uh-huh.
That's very typical. you're going to get multiple sensations out of a single sensory board. Now, I can sort of use myself as an example here, because when I was a kid, I was the only child in the first grade who could see music, hear numbers, and smell color. I was a synesthetic. Uh-huh. Only in those days, they called me a liar.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit.
And I was punished for it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, you know, and that's something that is always going to stick in my mind. You know, conforming with your peers has always been encouraged in schools. And, you know, my own experience was I was called in by the school psychologist who had tested my kids, and he looks at me with great disdain and says, you know, your daughter is an independent thinker, and obviously you are, too. Like, I have a social disease. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, aren't they supposed to be?
Yeah, well, you know, they do indeed become very different or withdrawn, or they're acting out, or they're very independent, or they're very different in some manner. You know, the child's challenge is to survive. That's what children do. They survive, they adjust, they learn, they grow, they negotiate, and they compromise. That's what a child does in living and in growing up.
Okay.
If
yeah.
that child has a near-death experience, and they can't with anybody, they don't get any help, nobody listens, nobody pays any attention to the lights they see or the angels they talk with or you know, the things that they point out in their environment, if nobody's paying any attention to them, or if they're putting them down, or if they're making fun of them, then what's that kid going to do? They're going to shut up. So they're either going to repress that, or they're going to become unusually shy or withdrawn. Or they're going to go the other way and become angry and act out.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and life does encourage us all to conform to the social norm. But is it more difficult for these new kids?
Well, yeah, because they're going to see through things. They're going to see through behavior, and they're going to wonder why people are acting like that. They're going to know things that nobody else knows. Many times they're going to see and feel and live their future before it occurs. And, you know, they're just going to be a little odd. Many child experiencers of near-death states grow up feeling alien. They grow up feeling like they came from another, and they really didn't. They came from this one. They just got reconfigured somehow and
so
turned
like
around
these,
and
these
shifted.
People who think that they are alien abductees.
Yeah, they could... They
you know, how is that related to near-death experiences? You know, to...
Well, you know, you're going to have to get really deep into that one to really follow it through, and I don't think we can do that
on this radio show. Yeah.
Because, you know, I'd have to get into the brain and how it processes things and, you know, what's real, what isn't real. And I hope to be able to do that in my theoretical model. But
this is going to be a cliffhanger question because we're going to probably have to go to break right after I tell you. Yeah, the question was about during a near-death experience, have you ever had a case where the original spirit leaves and a different one then occupies the body?
No, I have not. But I'm very familiar with the walk-in theory.
Uh-huh.
And I do challenge that theory. I challenge it for this reason. I have met some people who I think really are walk-ins.
Uh-huh.
Most of them who claim they are, I really do not think they are. And for this reason, most people who come back from a near-death experience feel as if they're a different person. And they do have traits, they do act differently in many ways than they did before. However, if you take a good look at what's happening, they're coming back as an expanded version of the original model. In other words, they're the same soul. They're just more of themselves. They're an expansion of themselves. And what many of the near-death experiencers comment on is that the soul itself, our soul, your soul, my soul, is so powerful, so huge, that no one's body could ever encompass all of it. It would burn up the body. So experiences like this, peak experiences, spiritual experiences, shamanic vision quests, Kundalini breakthroughs, transformations of consciousness, go on and on and on. The near-death experience is one of those. When we go through these kinds of impactful experiences, they enable us to hold
our last break of the evening. Folks, so stay tuned, and the Donna Shades will be right back with our guest, PMH Atwater, and another cliffhanger.
You are listening to the Paranormal Radio Network.
You know,
into UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is James Arthur Lanchick from the Black Knight Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth, in the path to non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Father, a show with the gun's own merits, and that's how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality. All time pre-drawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings there. Pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or highway attitudes. But there are no free passes here either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. Like a contradiction in the final chapter.
Welcome back to the Donna Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and we're talking tonight of childhood near-death experiences with TMH Atwater. If you would like to call in with a question or comment, you may do so at 1-877-786-0562 or by joining our virtual audience at www.paltalk.com in the Paranormal Radio Network room in Social Issues. You can always get the show's schedule at www.giascott.com. as well as contact me through the site with your questions and comments. PMH, before we get started again...
Oh, yes, another cliffhanger.
Yep, we need to go back and cover the cliffhanger.
Well, you know, we were talking about walk-ins and the usual spiel for identifying yourself as a walk-in is that most of them came from the near-death experience. And that's when the soul walked in. The old soul left, the new soul comes in.
Uh-huh.
And I'm challenging that simply because you can go back as a researcher point for point and look at the expansion or the differences afterward, and they trace exactly to the person that was there before is the person that's there afterward. They're just an expanded model of who they were before. So it's not a different soul. It looks as near as any of us can tell. The older soul, the same soul, you know,
the original
a stronger, better model of the original one.
Okay.
So, you know, I go into this in my books. I hope that's helpful. I wanted to jump right in here before we leave this particular strain of talk, this particular aspect of our conversation. And I want to talk about, at least briefly, some of the special health precautions for child experiencers.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of this is true for an adult as well, but with a child it's a little bit more complicated. When we're talking about the after effects, blood pressure, although more adults didn't exhibit, you know, a change in blood pressure after the experience, and invariably the blood pressure drops. I think we need to be aware, especially with adult experiencers, when we talk to our doctors, we need to educate them that low blood pressure is typical for an experiencer afterward, that they are not displaying chronic fatigue syndrome, for instance.
Uh-huh.
They should not be treated chemically, for instance. Because this is normal and typical. With light sensitivity, this is especially prominent with children, most experiencers come back very sensitive to light afterwards.
Are they prone to sunburn worse?
Yes. There are also prone...